to Mr. Biz Radio, Biz Talk for Biz Owners. If you're ready to stop faking the funk and take your business onward and upward, this show is for you. And now, here's Mr. Biz, Ken Wentworth.
All right, welcome to another episode of Mr. Biz Radio with me, Mr. Biz Ken Wentworth. And this week we're going to talk about, there's got a whole bunch of different things I want to talk about with our guest this week. He is a repeat guest. We had such a good time talking with him the last time he was on that I asked him to come back on. And actually, we scheduled him on the show right after we finished the last show because I knew it would be, I mean, there's so many other things I wanted to talk to him about after the first show. One of the things we are going to talk about is using a business to create wealth, because again, we've got a lot of business owners, entrepreneurs, wantrepreneurs that watch and listen to the show. So I wanted to make sure we kind of touch on some of that, but we're going to touch on a whole lot of different things. Our guest this week is Mr. Chris Volk. He is a three-time NYSE listed company leader, two-time company founder, successful financier of thousands of middle market companies, and most recently the author of The Value Equation, a business guide to wealth creation for entrepreneurs, leaders, and investors. He is passionate about entrepreneurship and how business models create wealth, and we are glad to have him back on Mr. Biz Radio for more of his insights. Chris, welcome back to the show.
And I'm absolutely delighted to be here. It's nice to see you.
Yeah, it's great to see you as well. So I guess, for those who didn't see the first show that you were on, which, by the way, if you haven't, go back and check that out. It was several months ago now, but it was an awesome show. Like I said, it was so great. I'm like, gosh, Chris, you got to come back on. But tell us a little bit about your journey. I know it's a long one, but give us the shorter version, I guess, your entrepreneurial journey.
Yeah, I'll try to give you the Cliff's Notes version.
Yeah, there you go.
I was not a born entrepreneur, but I started my career in banking. And I ended up migrating from Georgia to Arizona and started working with a small company that did sale leasebacks with chain restaurant operators. So think about a restaurant operator can either own the building or rent it from a landlord. We were that landlord, and we would buy the restaurant for him. It would save him a lot of money. It would actually increase his returns on equity. And that's what we did. And I was, my late 20s, early 30s. And by the time I was 36, I decided that we should take the company public. And so when I was 38, we took it public, and I ended up becoming president of the company. And after being public for 7 years, sold it. I sold it to GE Capital, so no longer around, but big financing company. And I stayed there for 18 months and left. And I decided that I had a shot to start my own business. And I was 47, I think, at the time. And I thought, this would be a good time to get it done. So I the original founder and myself of the first company started a second company, and we listed that on the New York Stock Exchange, ultimately sold that. And then years later, I took another team when I was about 55 years old, started my third NYSE company and ran it for 10 years and stepped down to do things like this and to write a book and to talk about entrepreneurship.
Yeah, so I guess let's get into that a little bit. So the vantage point that you have now of everything, and I know we were talking before we came on air here, but what are some of the things that you're seeing? Everyone's talking about the R word. Are we in a recession? Are we not in a recession? The economic downturn. I know you and I think had some similar thoughts on, while the economy might be down a bit, it does create a lot of opportunity. So what are some things you're seeing from your vantage point, Chris?
Yeah. So, you and I were talking about this just part of the show, but in 2019, I was fortunate enough to win a regional award from Ernst & Young for Entrepreneur of the Year out in the Southwest. And so now today I judge this with the folks from EY and other judges. And so we've started doing this year's round of investors and companies. And I would tell you, you get so excited watching all the businesses that are out there, and some of them are biotech and some of them are genomics. Some of them are roofing companies. There's a company that's doing automated handwritten thank you notes. So they span the gamut from technology to running restaurants to running roofing companies and consolidating businesses. And I personally get excited about all of this. And so when we talk about a recession, it's hard for me to always see it when I'm talking to entrepreneurs who are so perpetually positive anyway. And it makes you just sort of feel good.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I know we talked again right before we started the show here, but I think what I found is you see people, I recognize, and I was saying this middle of last year. Like, we're in a recession. The classic definition of recession, we're in it. We were in it the middle of last year, right? Two consecutive quarters of declining GDP. However, just because I'm using the R word, I don't think about it the way a lot of other people, I think about it, because I think of it as a time of opportunity. If you've positioned yourself in a way, some of your competitors haven't. And it's going to create a lot of opportunity, not only for new businesses and new startups and things. I know you and I were talking about a little bit about some of the amazing businesses that were hatched during the last economic downturn in, you know, the 2008, 2009 timeframe. But also the opportunity, if you own a roofing company, to say, you know, not all your competitors are prepared for this downturn. And they may have limped through COVID and just starting to recover. And then, you know, the economy starts to have some challenges. They may not make it through. So it presents some opportunities to seize some market share, not in a nefarious way. Even during COVID, I had one client who, two of his competitors went out of business during COVID. And, you know, we were able to buy some business assets at dimes on the dollar. We were able to re-employ people who were going to be losing their jobs. In two of the cases, the owners were, you know, they're baby boomers. They're getting a little bit older, and they were kind of wanting to, you know, maybe hang on for a few more years. And they're like, hey, this is it. I don't want to do this anymore. And so they kind of got a little, not necessarily a golden parachute in the corporate world, but, you know, something like that. They were able to get out of the business. Their employees stayed employed. They were able to get out of the assets and things like that. And it was a huge opportunity for my client. So, you know, I think it's just how you view these things. And Chris, I think you probably agree with that as well.
Oh, totally. I mean, one of the companies I was talking to today was environmental remediation company. So they're dealing with asbestos removal. They're dealing with fire damage and cleaning up companies' buildings that incur this kind of damage and need this kind of remediation. And for them, a lot of the opportunity is consolidation. So they engaged a private equity firm to come in and put some money in alongside of them. And they're buying up other companies around the country. We've seen this in lumber supply. I've seen this in with a roofing company, similar type of thing. So there are indeed a lot of opportunities out there for companies to grow in times like this.
Well, and especially I think it's almost like the perfect storm, because you have a lot of business owners that are baby boomers that are maybe, you know, in their 60s or so, that, you know, again, they were going to hang on for a few years, and they're like, okay, I made it through COVID and that's it. I don't want to go through this, you know, for the next 18, 24 months. It's time. And I think even outside, once the economy does kind of kick back up, and I think you're going to have, there's so much transfer of ownership that's going to happen over the next, you know, 3 to 5 years anyway, especially with a lot of these service companies, you know, the plumbers, the roofers, et cetera.
Right.
I think there's going to be a lot of that going on. And I think maybe the economy turning down is going to accelerate some of that.
Right. And I think also that business is the number one path to wealth. I mean, it's, you know, 2/3 of millionaires got their wealth through owning or running a business. And so if you're sitting there in a economy that's looking rough, it's just more incentive to say that, hey, I'm going to just try something new. I'm going to do this myself. And oftentimes that really works out incredibly well for people.
Yeah, definitely. Well, guys, this week, again, we're talking with repeat guest, Mr. Chris Volk. You can find out more at his website, thevalueequation.com. We'll put it in the show notes as well. Definitely go check that out. Come back after the break. We'll get the Mr. Biz tip of the week. And we're going to talk about efficiencies that cover 6 variables in business models.
If you would like to reach hundreds of thousands of business owners every week, Mr. Biz Radio can help. Our show airs globally 7 days a week for more than 25 hours across several internet radio stations, plus 20 plus podcast platforms. Also, video exposure on the new exclusive Mr. Biz Network streaming channel, which gets blasted to 100 plus streaming platforms, and the Mr. Biz YouTube channel, and our 350,000 social media followers multiple times every week. Join Mr. Biz Nation as an advertiser by emailing us at info@mrbizsolutions.com.
Are you ready to automate your business? Automation is the key to scaling a business and building wealth. It's also one of the most difficult things for a small business owner to do on their own. If you're looking for help with automation, Pulse Technology CRM can help. We have an exclusive offer for Mr. Biz Nation. We will build everything for free, even if it's a sophisticated funnel. visit thepulsespot.com/Mr. Biz for this exclusive offer.
Question for Mr. Biz you want answered on air? Email it to info@MrBizSolutions.com. Now, once again, here's Mr. Biz.
All right, welcome back to the show. It's time for Mr. Biz Tip of the Week. And I got to admit, I can't really claim this one. This is, the tip of the week. And sometimes I have quotes, as you guys know, but I actually kind of stole this one from Jamie Dimon, who is the chairman and CEO of JPMorgan Chase. Many of you know I worked there for a long time. And I, this is one of the things that, you know, there's a whole bunch of different things that he said that I just absolutely loved. If this is one I really like, especially as a small, medium-sized business owner, and that is to hire people who will ask for forgiveness versus ask for permission. And that sounds a little silly at the outset. What that means is hire people that aren't afraid to take the risk. The, you know, if someone's going to come to you as a leader in your company and constantly ask you about different things, you know, it's like, well, geez, why are they even there? Why are they a leader? Why are they a decision maker if they have to come to you all the time? Hire someone that has the chutzpah to be able to make some of those decisions. Are you going to agree with all of them? Maybe not. But, you know, obviously they're in that position because you trust their judgment in most cases. And I just always love that mentality of not being afraid to take some of those risks that are necessary to be successful in business. So that is the Mr. Biz Tip of the Week, courtesy of Mr. Jamie Dimon. All right, Chris. So let's talk a little bit about this. So I know, especially in your book, The Value Equation, you talk about, and we're going to talk about, you know, creating wealth with business and things like that. But I know one of the things that intrigued me as a self-professed numbers nerd is you talk about, you know, in business models, there's basically three efficiencies that are covered by six different variables. And I wondered if we could kind of dive into that a little bit and kind of dissect that.
Sure, happy to. I mean, first I'm going to say that three efficiencies and six variables is pretty simple. And my goal is to take business and try to reduce it to something that's simple. I'm going to make it a little simpler for you today. I'm going to talk about two variables. We'll start off with two and we'll talk about four efficiencies. So, and the four efficiencies that you start off with always are sales. I mean, and there's not a single business in the world that ever went out of business because they had too many sales. The second thing is your operating profit margin, which is basically your cash flow, at your cash profits after your costs, but before you pay for interest expense and before you're paying for rent, lease proceeds from people that are leasing stuff to you. And so that your operating profit margin and those two variables, you want to maximize those two. And they're associated with operating efficiency. So you want the most operating efficiency you can get. And the second efficiency is asset efficiency, which basically starts off with what's your business investment? And business investment is all the stuff that you have to fund with equity and borrowings and lease proceeds. And you want to make that as low as possible. And the last variable is your maintenance CapEx. How much money do you have to keep putting into the business every year to kind of keep what you've got, you know? And you want to keep that as low as possible. So on the capital efficiencies, I mean, on the asset efficiency side, you want to minimize that. Operating efficiency, you want to maximize that. And when you string those four things together, what you end up with is a return on equity that's without debt, of course, but it's a return on equity pre-leverage. And of course, no bank's going to lend you a nickel unless you can actually have positive cash flow to be able to pay for the debt service. And so that's where you start is sort of unlevered equity returns. Four variables, two efficiencies, that gets you there.
Yeah, and I think that's an important consideration that a lot of people don't consider is, well, number one, first of all, these four cover the gamut, I think. And I think they're very, while there's only four, it's pretty comprehensive as far as the different aspects of your business and how to measure those. But the other thing I love about your approach, Chris, is I think too often people just either way, way oversimplify things and they're doing their financials on the back of a napkin practically, or they're like going to Harvard for business school to try to figure things out. And it's like, not that there's anything wrong with that. And not that it's not good to understand some of those things in depth in that manner, but man, it's just like, you can really break things down and simplify things. What I found, and I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this, Chris, the more things that you give someone to pay attention to, the less any of them are getting done properly.
Well, this is true. And so if you're an entrepreneur, especially you're working by yourself, maybe you have a pretty lean staff, you don't have a lot of people that are going to rely, that you can rely on to get things done. And so you have to keep your list super, you know, super short and your tasks super simple. And so when you're focusing on business models, you're focusing on basically the four variables to start off with. And the reason this stuff is so important is because it's great to have a business and solve customers' problems and have your customers be happy with you. But unless you have a really good business model, unless you can wrap that customer service around a great business model, then it's hard to create a lot of wealth. So the wealth is what is driven by the business model, and it's how the richest people in the world got that way.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess along those lines, other than these four, what are some other things that you have seen, Chris, that are key measurables? So again, I'm kind of reiterating what I said earlier, but you know, I've gone into businesses that are clients that, you know, they're super proud. They're like, oh, Ken, let me show you our KPIs. And they've got 20 KPIs they measure. And it's like, well, you know, for me, the first thing I do is I say, you need five at the most. Take the other 15 and put them on page two or something like that. Or let's pick out the five key to start. What are the real needle movers for the business? Let's nail those down and really have focused attention on those and set some goals for those. Once we get them to a goal state and they're there for a quarter, we can move them to page two and move something else up to page one. We still monitor them, right? Make sure they stay where they need to be, things like that. But I think people, again, just sort of, overdo things a lot of times. So, is there anything else that you see, Chris, that is something that people really need to focus on that oftentimes you find that business owners just don't pay enough attention to?
Well, you know, no business ever went out of business because they had too much sales. They do go out of business because they can't control costs. So that's very important. They really go out of business because they run out of cash. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. So you can lose a lot of money, but if you run out of cash, that's the death knell. And so as you're focusing on trying to control your business investment and making sure you have a lot of liquidity, because liquidity is, I had a mentor once who said liquidity is everything, and it is.
Yeah, I agree 100%. So let me ask you this one. This is a little bit of a loaded question. How do you feel about budgets, Chris?
I feel good about budgets in the sense that, you know, budgets are goals that you're setting for yourself. If you don't set a goal for yourself, it's a problem. I mean, you need to put a line in the sand and say, this is what I'm going to accomplish this year. And the budget's a way of doing that. Now your budget, especially if you're starting off a business, your budget and your business model will invariably be wrong, which is why you want to have a business model that's got a big margin for error. You want to be able to make a lot of mistakes and still make a return for your investors, still make a return on the business. And if you can do that, then you're going to be in solid shape. So, you know, I've taken a lot of risks starting businesses, but they haven't been unreasonable risks. And I've always slept very well at night with the risks I've taken because I've been able to manage them.
Yeah. And the reason I said it's a loaded question is that's one of my, I call them three pillars of financial success. When I work with a client, even when I'm talking with a prospective client, if they don't have a budget, I said, we're going to create a budget. And if that's a deal breaker for you, then I'm not your guy, because I find that they're critically important because, again, it gives you something, as you mentioned, to measure back against the goals you have for the year. And again, invariably, there are going to be things you're going to get wrong and, you know, things are going to blow up the budget during the year, but you make adjustments to that and you're not just spending money frivolously and things like that. So I think it's very important for a budget to have a budget. And I think, those goals and goes right along with that. But guys, we're talking with Chris Volk this week. We're going to hit a break. We're going to come back. Check out his book, The Value Equation, at thevalueequation.com.
How would you like to have direct access to Mr. Biz to help you run your business more profitably and more efficiently? At MrBizSolutions.com, you get live access to not only Mr. Biz, but also several of his hand-picked and trusted business experts, each with 20-plus years of experience to help you optimally manage and grow your business. That's just the start of where Mr. Biz Solutions begins. Learn more at MrBizSolutions.com. That's MrBizSolutions.com.
Business owners have a continually growing to-do list with little time for revenue-producing activities. With Check Off Your List and their experienced team of virtual assistants, you can focus on growing your business. Visit checkoffyourlist.com to learn how Check Off Your List's skilled team can handle your day-to-day tasks like social media, bookkeeping, calendar maintenance, and much more. Contact Check Off Your List at checkoffyourlist.com or call 888-262-1249 to see how their virtual assistants can help you live to work rather than work to live.
Check out all three of Mr. Biz's best-selling books at MrBizBooks.com. Now, once again, here's Mr. Biz.
All right, welcome back to the show. And we are going to pick Chris's brain a little bit here. You can hear with his vast experience and the success that he's had in the entrepreneurial space and business ownership space. So, Chris, I know one of your big things, especially in your book, The Value Equation, is creating wealth through a business. What are some of the ways to use a business as an engine to create that generational wealth that so many people are looking for?
Well, the number one way of creating huge generational wealth is to have a business model. And you start off with the four variables and the two efficiencies we talked about. Mm-hmm. And you want to create returns for shareholders that are more than what they expect and more than what they need. And basically every company that's created huge amounts of wealth, if you're looking at the Forbes 400 or whatnot, all these people are made their money in business, and they all had phenomenal business models generating returns that were higher than what investors needed to make. And so basically the owners got to keep the spread. I mean, that's what happens. Now you can be worth, you know, you can make millions of dollars just by having a company that doesn't create a lot of wealth. In other words, it's not really worth much more than the cost to create, but you're building up equity in it over time. And that's good, because, you know, if you're just a W-2 employee, all you're doing is putting money in a 401k, or you're putting money into an IRA, and that's one thing. If you're owning a business, even if it creates no real incremental wealth, at least you're building up equity in that business, which is a second way of, you know, creating wealth for yourself. But the third way is to create a business that's generating a return that's higher than what people want. And that is the way that turbocharges your wealth to get you into sort of a level of wealth that's going to be high. And if you're thinking about people that are worth $5 or $10 million or more than that, $50 million, this is generally how they've made their wealth.
Yeah. And I think I'm glad you brought that up, because it's interesting. Another thing that, you know, when I worked at JP Morgan, one of the things that, you know, Jamie Dimon talked about along those lines, is even as we are W-2 employees, he said, you know, if you think about employees that have become wealthy in the Silicon Valley companies and things like that, he said they didn't get wealthy by getting 10% pay increases every year. They got wealthy through ownership, right? Through stock ownership. And you know, in a way, I mean, a very small minority ownership, right? But, you know, that's in building that wealth within the company. And so that's how, even working for a Microsoft, a Google, and things like that throughout the years, Facebook, et cetera, you know, in a way, if you think about it, it's a form of business ownership, a very minority, as I mentioned, minuscule ownership stake, but that created a ton of wealth, not the 10% pay increases every year and things like that.
No, it's almost impossible to, well, let's look at it this way. There are 12% of Americans that I've seen that are millionaires, and it drops off to, if for Americans that have $2 million, it drops off to 6%. So basically, you know, a lot of Americans could save 12, you know, they could save $1 million, but it's really hard to save $2 million. And as you get further up above $2 million, the way you get there is by owning something, not by earning something. And so, Ken, you're right on that stuff. You got to own something. You got to own a piece of the pie.
Yeah. It was interesting. And it's one of the things I love too about, again, I keep going back to my corporate career, but, you know, as folks that are out there that are watching or listening, that maybe you're not a business owner, you say, oh, it doesn't apply to me. It can apply to you, because I'll tell you, one of the things, you know, as you ascend the ranks, at least I think at a lot of companies, but especially, you know, a Fortune 15 company like JP Morgan, mm-hmm. you know, once you get above a certain level, your annual bonus, you're required a big chunk of it, and it becomes an increasingly large chunk of your bonus and your compensation throughout the year, and your overall compensation is in the form of stock ownership. Because, you know, as Jamie Dimon mentioned, you know, back then, as he said, I want people to eat their own cooking, so to speak, right? You want to help create the wealth in the company, and then you're required to hold it. You couldn't sell that stock, so you're not making short-term decisions that are, you know, just going to make a short-term return and then have devastating impacts down the road, where we've seen with, you know, companies. I just did a video about Bed Bath & Beyond. It's like, holy crap, but what happened there? You know, And I started diving into some of the things that, they did and some of the mistakes they made and some of the very short term, you know, decisions they were making that just, I can't even imagine. I didn't even look into the leadership and their background, but I was amazed at some of the things I found when I was sort of digging through their financials and like, why would they make some of those decisions they made? It was just crazy. But the impact being, you know, having that long-term view of building that equity in the company, building that wealth, and returning to shareholders, like you had mentioned, Chris.
Right. I mean, the whole thing is owning a piece of the action. So if you're a senior executive in a company, you're invariably going to own some stock. And if you're not owning some stock, you should go somewhere else where somebody's right. going to give you a piece of stock. And of course, if you're starting a company, then it goes without saying that you're an equity owner. But owning something is where people really create huge amounts of wealth. It's hard to save yourself into wealth with a W-2.
So, and I think I know the answer to this based on your first company, but how important do you think does real estate play into all of that?
Well, you know, real estate's is a business in and of itself. So, I mean, if you're owning apartment complexes or whatever, it's a business in and of itself. And the rules for that business are the same as the rules for any other business, whether it's biotechnology or anything else. And the rules are, if you can generate returns that are higher than what other people want, you know, you're going to be able to sell that business for a lot more money. And so, and sometimes real estate and land is a store of wealth. So you can just sit on it for a long period of time and it could be a store of wealth. The big money that gets made in people's lifetime, the kind of stuff where people can shift their net worths in 4 or 5 years to something really meaningful, that all happens, tends to happen anyway with operating businesses. So it could be as simple as a restaurant. It could be a finance business. It could be biotech. It could be doing a roofing supply company, plumbing. But it tends to be owning a business and being able to generate returns on that business that are higher than what people want, and then being able to sell that business eventually for multiples of what you paid for it.
Yeah. I mean, I think a big part of that for me, at least, I know as an investor myself, you know, looking at businesses now, when I get approached to look at a business to potentially purchase a piece of it or the whole thing, generally speaking, if there's not real estate with it, if they don't own the building they're in, the land they're on, I'm typically not interested because I want to know that I at least have that asset that's all, you know, that's a big part of that business. Whether the business has some struggles or not, I still have that asset. And I think, you know, that's, you know, again, like a long-term play on overall in your, you know, portfolio. And again, you don't want everything in real estate. You got to balance things out a little bit, but I think that's an important consideration that people should make as well.
Well, I made my living for the better part of my career in convincing people, convincing companies that they were better off not owning their real estate.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because they were better off having a landlord than a banker. And I was going to be their landlord. And there were reasons for that, because the return I was going to make on their real estate was going to be less than the return that they were going to make on their business. Mm-hmm. And there were many, many reasons beyond that why businesses oftentimes are not better off owning a lot of real estate. You look at companies like Kohl's or whatever, that's another retailer chain. I mean, they own a lot of real estate. It hasn't really done them a lot of favors to own this real estate from a return on equity perspective. There's been a lot of value destruction that happens with companies that own too much real estate. But for us and for our shareholders, owning real estate was the business we were in. I mean, and so it was an asset-backed business. And you do have that comfort of maybe you're not going to make the highest returns in the world. Our business model wasn't near as good as Microsoft's or near as good as Apple's, but we were asset backed and there was a cushion to it, and we didn't have a lot of debt on our company. And so you had limited downside, you had some decent upside, and we were able to give that to our shareholders. And we outperformed the broader benchmarks, including the S&P 500 and basically every company I ever ran.
Yeah. Yeah. Powerful stuff, Chris, powerful stuff. Well, we're out of time here, but again, we were talking with Chris Volk. You can follow him on social media, LinkedIn, et cetera. But make sure you go out and check out his website, thevalueequation.com. Like I said, we'll put it in the show notes as well. But Chris, thanks so much for coming back on the show. I really appreciate it.
And Ken, it's my pleasure. And so good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you as well. Guys, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Have a great rest of your week. And as always, don't forget, cash flow is king.
become part of Mr. Biz Nation. Follow him on all social media platforms or never miss a show by going to MrBizRadio.com. If you prefer free video content, visit the Mr. Biz YouTube channel or check out his streaming channel, which is available on 100-plus streaming platforms at MrBizNetwork.com.